good things about her is she does have a home group, a sponsor, and a sobriety date.
Hi, everybody. I'm Debbie Harris, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Debbie! Love you, Debbie! Lots and lots and lots! Oh, bunches!
Okay, we got that over now. Okay. Hi, everybody. I'm glad to be here, and I'd like to thank Mary and the committee and everybody involved, Stacy, for all that's happened so far. It's a delight to be a part of your convention this weekend. And I must say, I don't recall hearing Chapter 5 quite so animatedly. If you are new in Alcoholics Anonymous and didn't quite understand what was happening, it's the first three pages of Chapter 5. I invite you to read them. And for all of you who were chanting along with the staffs, I just hope that you've all taken them. I take my participation in Alcoholics Anonymous very seriously. And to me, a podium of Alcoholics Anonymous is a place of respect. And because, as was earlier said about our activity and behavior in the facilities, that's what was told to me when I was introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous by the old-timers, that I may be the only example of Alcoholics Anonymous or a copy of the big book they read. And I don't ever want to be the person they might point to and say, well, if that is Alcoholics Anonymous or how they behave, no thanks. We have a real responsibility, and I take my mind very seriously, because whether it be in home or work, in the supermarket, anywhere, in an AA meeting, I always want to be the best example of Alcoholics Anonymous I can be. And we all have that responsibility to carry on. There are three things to me that are the foundation. And they were already mentioned tonight, and I believe in them strongly. And I think, for me, they're the three most important things about me. And to begin with is a sobriety date. My sobriety date is February the 8th, 1976, which means I've been sober a little over 17 years. That's for Alcoholics Anonymous, not for me, because there have been many days when I didn't want to stay sober, but did. Because I didn't want to be drunk anymore. I didn't want to have to stand up as a newcomer. In our area, under 30 days, we ask people under 30 days to stand up so we can get to know them. And I don't ever want to stand up again. It's a good reason for not taking a drink, I'll tell you. But I believe that you need a sobriety date. And if you are new to Alcoholics Anonymous and don't have a sobriety date, I encourage you to get one. Alcoholics Anonymous will make a lot more sense when you're sober. And to me, sobriety is the absence of everything, be it a drink or a pill or a tablet form or smoking or snorting or shooting form. But I am an alcoholic. And I don't tell you that date to impress you, because it's not my first sobriety date, but it is my last one. There are people in this room sober longer than I am. I just want you to know I have one. And it is the beginning. This is physical sobriety makes possible the rest of the things to happen, but it's not the beginning and the end. It is the start. The physical sobriety start. The steps and traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous must be applied in your life if you want to have comfortable sobriety. I have not drank for periods of time, but being comfortable was certainly not a word that I could have included in that. Today I include comfortable, and I like being comfortable. I've never lived well with conflict, and then or now. And so I do what I need to do, and then some. And that's really what makes the difference on my sobriety. That has got to be, without question, my honest date. I've talked to a lot of people who have lived with the lie of their sobriety date. And it's not one that I want to live with. And so I encourage you to get a sobriety date. That's where it all begins. The second and third thing to me are equally important, and that is a home group is one of them, and I'm a member of the Bellflower Big Book Group. I have been for 7 years since I moved to California. Prior to that, I was a member of the Skyline Group in Atlanta, Georgia for almost 7 years. And my first home group was the 12 and 12 group in Minneapolis for almost 4 years. And I believe in a home group, not because I have such great things to contribute, but because of the things that I get to learn to do there. I get to learn how to be of service, how to be one among many without getting the recognition or accolades, because I like being the center of attention and the star of the show and in the middle of everything and getting praise. And this shows me how to be just a part of and how to, I've learned how to do everything in my meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous that I apply outside to the world, how to behave properly at work, how to show up for commitments, how to be on time, how to be responsible, how to do what I say I'm going to do, what I'm going to do, and everything I've learned how to practice patience and tolerance and love and kindness toward each other, how to live with personality conflicts, how to place principles before personalities. I have learned how to do everything here in the safe rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous that I can take out there and live a little bit better. And I believe in a home group because it gives me a place where I need to be consistent and to keep showing up. If I tell you keep coming back, I better be there too. So when you come back, you see me. And the other thing is a sponsor. I've had three sponsors in sobriety because I have lived in three different states, and that's the only reason I've changed sponsors. And I'm very glad about that because it's a very important relationship to me. I was 3 years sober when I got my first official sponsor, and I say it that way for a reason, because I would have sponsors my first 3 years of sobriety, but it was sort of like people maybe who they were friends or somebody 6 months sober longer than I am, and in my case that didn't work very well. I need somebody, you know, who's been sober a good deal longer than I. I want someone who is an active member of Alcoholics Anonymous, not telling me from their living room couch, I think you ought to go to meetings. I want to see them in those meetings. I want them active. I don't want them staying on the fringes and telling me what to do. And I've always had very, very active sponsors. And probably, you know, the thing that they've all had in common has at the top of the list would be that they are all people who I want to be like when I grow up. They have worn and wear Alcoholics Anonymous so beautifully. They show me what it looks like to live the steps and traditions in your life. And that's what I want to do when I grow up. And so if you are new here or old and you're restless, irritable, and discontent and you don't have one or all three of these things in your life, a sponsor, a home group, or a sobriety date, I hope you do something about it very soon. I hope you and encourage you to get these things in your life and utilize them actively in your life, because I guarantee you this, that when you do, your life will change. It will if you want it to. I don't want to live that old way anymore, and you don't have to either. My first drink was the same night as my first drunk. I was 12 years old. It was Friday the 13th. I still love Fridays. They're my favorite night of the week. There's something magical about Fridays. And lots of things would happen to me on Fridays. And it was April of 1970. Now, I told you I was 12 years old. That makes me 36 today, so we'll get the numbers out of the way. I would be the first person I saw drunk. I had never seen anybody drunk before, but I had been invited to this party by the cool kids in school. And you see, there was a group, you know, there's all kinds of people in school, just like there are today. I mean, there were the people who were athletically gifted and talented, and I certainly didn't fit there. And then there were the people who were academically just inspiring, and I certainly didn't belong there either. And then there were the group that, you know, skipped school, smoked cigarettes, and drank beer, and that's who I wanted to be around. And they looked like they were having fun, and they were the cool kids in school. And they had invited me to this upcoming party on Friday night, and I had heard them talk about drinking, and it was, wow, you know, this is like my debut here. You know, I'm my initiation, and I'm going to be a part of this group, and I have to, well, I made a decision to get drunk that night. Now, I didn't know how you did it. I just kind of figured you must have to drink a lot to get there, because I'd never seen anybody get there. But I figured you had to do that, and that was what I had set out to do and would do that night for the first time. Yet, the little 12-year-old girl who took her first drink, there was absolutely no reason to. You see, a friend of mine in my home group says that if my environment would have predicted whether or not I would be an alcoholic, I would not be an alcoholic. You'd have a different talk here tonight. Because you see, I started in the Midwest. I was raised up in some small towns in South Dakota. I was raised up in the Catholic school, raised up my first 5 years in Catholic school, in the Catholic church. I was an only child. It was about as American and apple pies you can get. My mother stayed home and baked cookies, and my father went off to work, and there was no abuse of any kind. I've never seen them have an argument. There wasn't furniture flying through the house in a drunken rage, or it was just a very loving home. They cared about me. I didn't want for anything. So there was certainly no reason, nothing that I'm running away from or trying to escape from whatsoever. And there's no alcoholism in my family at all. Up and down the lines, left and right, we have not been able to find any alcoholism, yet I certainly have it. And so they didn't really know what to do with me for a long, long time because they'd never seen anything happening. They just always figured that soon I would be with the wrong crowds. But what happened that particular night was I would have my first drink. And you see, my parents had set an excellent example of drinking for me. Because as I remember drinking, it was what I learned today, it's called social drinking. They were the kind of people who would have company over maybe half a dozen times throughout the year or whatever for dinner. They'd have their guests over and they'd pour them a drink, one. And, you know, they've taken this dusty whiskey bottle down off the top shelf and it literally is dusty because the last time they used it, they would pour their guests a drink, one, and they would put in ice and mix and foo-foo and whatever else they put in there, cap it and shelve it for another undetermined amount of time. And they could have a bottle of booze last them months and months and months on end. I mean, it was just irrelevant to them whether they had it or not. It would last that long until I started to drink, let's put it that way. And then it began to vanish. And what happened is they would drink that drink, they'd have dinner, and they'd still be sipping this thing, and they would play cards, and then because they had been drinking, they would make coffee and sandwiches before their guests went home, and, you know, it just, who drinks like that, you know? I mean, I have never drank like that, and I have never thought about drinking like that, and I would be embarrassed to drink like that, you know? It's, what would be the point, you know? And so I certainly had a good example. However, what was natural to them, I would never understand, nor would they ever understand the way I drank. Because you see, within a very short period of time, what was as natural to them as this, to me, would be I would take that fresh whiskey bottle, uncap it, throw the cap away, because I'll never need it again. I will drink that bottle that night as fast as I can and not think anything unusual of it. That will be the way that I would drink for the next 6 years. So when I arrived at this party this night, it was a very important night for me. It was a big deal. I do remember my first night. Remember everything about it, except for the blackouts portions, of course. But what happened to me was I arrived there at 6 o'clock, and it would set the patterns for me. I would always want to arrive as early as possible and get started. And when you're 12 and 13 years old and you get together, it's kind of like a liquid potluck. You know, y'all brought something or stole something from somewhere. And you pass it around and you mix it up and God knows what you're drinking. And it would never make any difference to me if it was straight or mixed or liquor or beer on ice or out of the bottle. I would have my favorites eventually, but it really wouldn't matter all that much. And they began to, I'm ready to get started, you know, and they're finally get this bottle going around, and it, when it reaches me, I take a long pull off of this thing, and I'm not really sure what's going to happen quite yet, and as it's going down, it's burning, and I'm thinking, I think that's a good sign, you know, I think it's working, and I'll tell you what, when it hit like hot velvet, and it just went out, and I just started to feel warm on the inside. And I didn't know I had a gut full of hot rocks until they started cooling down. And I didn't know I had a gut full of knots until they started to unravel themselves. And I think what makes me an alcoholic is what happened when I took my second drink. Because you see, I've heard people from this podium say, I drank too much. I've never drank too much, in my opinion. I'd like to know what that quantity is. I haven't gotten there yet. I don't think you can drink too much. I mean, we get topped out, I think, but I've never read any minimum quantity in order to be an alcoholic here at all. I've never heard or read anywhere of you have to drink at least X length of time, or, sorry, you can't come in. That isn't what, to me, I understand makes me an alcoholic. The difference between me and those little kids, other little kids at night, since I was the only one who got drunk, is defined for me in the doctor's opinion when he makes the statement that men and women drink essentially for the effect produced by alcohol. Because you see, that's what happened to me when I took that second drink. Because when it came to me, and I remember taking that second drink, and I'd been thinking how nervous I had been, and God, I just, you know, I kind of like now, I can't barely swallow, and I'm nervous, and I'm just, oh, God, he's here, and oh, she's here, and oh, is my hair all right, and, you know, am I just, everything okay? And after that second drink, it's sort of like you have that change happen, and you throw your shoulders back, and you put your head up, and you think, hey, aren't they glad I'm here? Just that thing about instant change of perception. And I liked it. That is what happened to me when I took that second drink. My first drink was to be accepted and approved by those people, and that'd be the last time I drank for that reason. The second drink, and for every drink the next 6 years, I drank for the effect. That is what makes me an alcoholic, because you see, my grandmother has never drank for the effect produced by alcohol. She does not have happen to her on the inside what happens to me. And neither did any of those other little kids in that room. And yet this is my first and only experience. The logical assumption is it happens to everybody. Everybody got drunk in my eyes that night. They didn't. Everybody experienced this effect. They didn't. But it's my only one. And I like it. I like this effect. And I don't even know what's happening, and I don't know any of these kinds of descriptions until I get into Alcoholics Anonymous and hear the people identify, and I begin to identify with them. That's the beautiful gift that we have here, is the one of identification. And so that night I would, as I say, set my patterns. I would black out. I would pass out. I was drugged home from the party 3 hours after I had arrived at 9 o'clock, and came to with my first case of the dry heaves. And I wanted to go back to the party because, God, I'd had a good time. Now, you know, who knows what happened? Who cared? But I got drunk, and drunk equaled good time. I mean, that was really what I was, that would be the equation for me. And I would find very early, in beginning that night, what I would, you always have people tell you, be glad to tell you what you did in a blackout. And to the point where you wish they'd have a blackout, you know, and you don't quite want to know everything. And so this was my first night of drinking, and I never forgot it. It seemed, as I look back, I mean, it just amazes me how quickly my attitude, my thinking, my emotional state changed. The things that had once been important, being a good student, being a good daughter, obeying, going by the rules, had always been important to me. I really don't like trouble. I don't like conflict. That sort of thing just really got pushed aside because I couldn't wait to drink again. The next morning, Saturday morning, my awakening thoughts are, how can I get some more for tonight? And I haven't even been 24 hours after my first drink. And a few girlfriends and I did get a few cases of beer that night and immediately got caught. Now, this is my first recollection of the statement that my solutions are always worse than the problem. And I have never been very good on my own solutions. That's why I have a sponsor. And when I got caught, it not one moment did it occur to me that perhaps at 12 years old I'm a little young to be drinking, and that maybe I should wait till I'm of legal age. You know, maybe it's, you know, maybe I should wait. Well, I'm here to say I've never had a legal drink of alcohol, because every time I got to that age they changed it. And so I've never had a legal drink of alcohol, but that was not my solution. My solution was, I'm going to have to learn how to lie better and find a better hiding place. And that was my solution. That was the first time I remember making a conscious decision like that. And it all was a protection of the alcohol. My drinking would be basically limited to weekends, but it was at certainly every given opportunity I took advantage of it. About a year later, I was introduced to the wonderful world of drugs, which allowed me to stay conscious longer before the inevitable blackout. Because by this time, I'm 13 years old, and I drink whiskey out of a bottle with a beer chaser. And that's the way I drink. And I don't think anything odd about that, except that I can't quite remember everything. And I'm not one who wants to be sleeping through life. I want to be smack dab in the middle of it. And so I find things that keep me awake. I find things that I like speed and acid, and that they will do that. And So this would become my kind of combination. And the last year and a half of my drinking, with very few days of exception, my diet basically consisted of a bottle of whiskey and a hit or two of acid. And that is the way I lived. That I didn't think anything unusual or odd about that at all. It had just progressed into this is a natural way for me to live. However, my father did think it unusual to live that way. And at 17, and this was on a Friday, I was committed to a hospital in Grand Forks, North Dakota, for alcoholism and drug addiction. Now, I'm 17 years old, and I don't understand why he has done this. I have recently been expelled for the third and final time from my senior year of high school, all for alcohol and drug-related problems. This is a small town. It's almost 20 years ago now when this happened, and nice girls don't get thrown out of high school 20 years ago, you know, and small towns where everybody knows what you had for breakfast, you know, and really knows your business. He was embarrassed by he tried all kinds of things to help me in his human power. But you see, he was a human power. And as was read tonight in the ABCs, no human power can relieve us of our alcoholism. Of course, I don't know that's what I have, but he tried. He sought professional advice. He was told that while you still have legal custody, you should put her in some sort of a hospital. And so that's what he did. That was his last effort to try something to help his daughter. He didn't know what else to do. And so I would be in this place for about 7 weeks. And I don't really know why I'm here. I'm not an alcoholic. They seem to think I have a problem. I don't have a problem. I'll do this to get the heat off because I was just really tired of fighting them. You know, I had been gone for 2 weeks and I showed up for more money and they nabbed me. I mean that's how I felt, and they took every opportunity to get me in there. And so I would be in there and I would learn a lot of information about alcoholism, and I'd hear this language of that we talk about here that I'd never heard before. And and of course on Friday nights we would be taken to outside meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. And since I'm not an alcoholic, there's really no reason for me to sit up front and listen. So I would find the farthest back corner I could and sit there. And the problem was every now and then I would listen to what the speaker was saying. And they were doing the very same thing I'm doing. They were sharing their experience, strength, and hope with the group and what had happened to them. And every now and then I would tune into them and I would hear some things that up here I would rationalize away. The problem was, I was in my own small way, I was beginning to identify inside. And I didn't want to. This would be the beginning of the end. This would begin the conflict for me. They would say things like they had lost their family because of alcoholism, because of their drinking. And I thought to myself, I wanted to lose my family. You know, I thought that was, considered that an asset. I wanted to get rid of them. You know, they were constantly on my back and in my face about my drinking, and, you know, I just leave me alone. And yet that was how I could rationalize it, but the problem was, is inside, I knew that because of my drinking, it had caused a tremendous amount of problems in that home, and it was really for everybody's safety that I leave, because towards the end, it was more of you wanted to be around me when I was drinking, not when I wasn't. We talk about that Jekyll and Hyde, and when the not drinking times rolled around, it was that Hyde that was coming out. It wasn't the nice guy, because all this stuff was inside, and I didn't know what it was, but I knew what would take it away. And they talked about things like totaling out cars, and I was a driving drunk. I was in my car a lot and drove, and I looked at that and I thought, you know, well, I've never totaled out a car, not officially. I had a little drunk car that arrived at Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, where it started off square, but it kind of gets rounded out with those drunk bumps, little personality to it, but I'd never totaled out a car. That was the big difference. They talked about jails and prisons and institutions that they had been in, and I thought, my God, I mean, you know, there's a lot of criminals in these rooms, and, you know, It doesn't apply to me. I've only been in jail 3 times, and every time it was a misunderstanding, you know. I'm different. They talked about losing jobs because of their drinking, and I had to remember it. It took a while. Maybe I have been fired from a few. Maybe I've been asked to quit from a few. But my problem really was I always had a little job. I mean, when I was there, I worked. You know, it was just, is she coming in today or isn't she, and what condition? And the problem was is that when I would quit, I usually quit in blackouts. And of course, I didn't know I had quit. So I'd, you know, show up like normal the next day, and those are very awkward moments. Really are. And they talked about drunk driving charges, and I thought, hey, you know, I never had any drunk driving charges, but the reason I didn't is because for my last year, I worked for the city judge. And I knew all the police on the force, and so when they would stop me for drunk driving, they took away my booze and told me to go home. So these are the kinds of things that up here I rationalized away. But in my own small way, I was beginning to identify. But there was a couple things that they said that I couldn't deny, that I couldn't rationalize away, that I didn't want to hear about. And they talked about all those broken promises. And the face of my father just flashed right up. And because there had been so many that the last year that I lived in their home, I tried to avoid him at all costs because he would always try to extract one of those from me again. And I just, there was always the tagline, no matter what, of be good. And in our language, be good meant, and don't drink or take any drugs. And as sincere as I felt, as much as I wanted to do that, it was impossible to do that. I didn't know I was an alcoholic. I didn't know that I was powerless over this disease. And neither did he. Neither did he. And the other thing they talked about was there was a woman I remember who said that she remembered trying to scrub away the smell. And that got my attention. Because that was one thing I had never, ever, ever discussed with my other two alcoholic girlfriends, and I can call them that today because happily one of them is sober in Alcoholics Anonymous again 2.5 years. I see her generally every other week in the LA area. And the other one, we're still saving her a seat, that she was sober for about 3-4 years at one time, but drinking proved to be more interesting to her. So I never told them about that smell. Not that, you know, I mean, we probably smelled each other and didn't really even notice it, but the thing of it was is that I remember trying to scrub away that smell and trying to puff and powder and perfume it away, and it was still there. And it was an odd smell, and I just couldn't seem to get rid of it. And this woman was talking about that it was booze coming through her pores. And now, I'm no rocket scientist, but I know I'm naive. I was then, am today, probably will be forever. But I never one time thought that it was booze coming through my pores. The thing that frightened me with the identification is that I knew that she knew what that smell smelled like. Now that didn't get me sober, but it never left my mind. And so I would stay in this halfway house. I would be then sent to a halfway house after 7 weeks. I'd be there 9 months. I arrived there on a Friday night, and I don't like women, and now I'm going to live with 40 of them. It wasn't a real... And so I would go to these meetings because I was too stupid to go to the movies and sign my own little slip of paper. So I'd go, and I was really glad y'all were there. You know, glad this works for you. I just know I'm going to drink again, so stay away. And this particular period of my life is a great reminder for the lesson that just because I don't drink or take any drugs and I show up at meetings now and then does not ensure me sobriety by any means. Sobriety to me is a way of life. All I was doing was not drinking, the physical act of drinking. But I wasn't doing anything to clean up the inside, which is where the steps and the traditions come in. We begin with the steps. That's what cleans up my life, that I can then obtain some comfortable sobriety, and I don't have to live with the demons in the past anymore. And So what happened during this period of time is I didn't change the way I looked or acted or talked. I kept every old little silly image that I had. I didn't change anything about me. And the day would finally come when I went out to California to visit my mother for a 2.5-week holiday at the end of the year. And my first week out there was absolutely miserable because naturally I'm going to be hanging around with people that I know who used to drink, and they used to drink, or I used to drink and take drugs with them. I mean, why would I call AA people? They probably don't even have AA in California. I mean, who cares anyway? And I'm not going to make the effort to look it up. And the last week and a half, I was drunk. And what is really significant about that today is that though my mother and I have never been very close, they divorced when I was 12 and 13, and she moved to California, and I would always make visits, and this would be my first Christmas visit out there, and of course I'm drunk the last week and a half and trying to avoid her at all costs. I haven't spent many, if very, very few holidays with her in the past 18 years, but what was very nice is that this Christmas, just a few weeks ago that we had, I was able to be with her on Christmas Day, and it was sober 18 years later. And I was really, that's because of Alcoholics Anonymous and the things that we get to do here. We get to set right the wrongs. And that was really, for me, a real joy, a special gift. And so I'm out there, and I am just absolutely miserable because, you see, something's definitely wrong here. I am doing the same kinds of things I used to do, but something's wrong. It must be California. I mean, if only I was with my old friends, if only I was with my, you know, in my old places, it'd be different. The problem was I had been to too many meetings, and I knew it wouldn't be different. I knew that maybe I am an alcoholic. And you see, it's getting closer. I'm not quite there yet, but to me, when I'm getting closer to admitting maybe I have those symptoms, but they still seem to apply to somebody else, really, not to me. And I remember being face down on the floor, and the reason, because I can't get off the floor. I am drunk, physically drunk right up to here. But this is still working very soberly. And you see, I don't know what anyone else's definition of it quit working is, but I'll tell you what mine is. It is face down on that floor, and I am physically drunk and can't get off it. But this, what I really need shutting off, will not. And it's all those symptoms that kept coming in and being just magnified, the inability to control my drinking, the inability to predict my behavior once I take a drink. Just everything and everybody I've ever said and known, it goes out the window. All good intentions, all good hopes, all promises, they're gone. The phenomenon of craving, the obsession, the tremendous power that this has over me and my comfort. It's getting closer. And I get back to Minneapolis, and I've taken the attitude of I've learned my lesson. And I step my meetings up from one a month to one a week. And when you're running your own life, one meeting a week sounds like a lot of meetings, you know? And so today, and I go to anywhere from 4 to 7 meetings a week. It just depends on the calendar. And I'm 17 years sober. And I feel more comfortable than going to one meeting a week. That's what works better for me. And so anyway, I'm back there, and I'm going to one meeting a week. And finally, I get a Friday, 5 weeks later, on a Friday, I get a letter in the mail with one joint in it from a friend in California. And like any still uncommitted alcoholic, I decide to keep it. Just in case. I may need it someday. I just didn't know it'd be the next day, you know. And came kind of early there. And that was the 7th of February, 1976. And, you know, I got sober when I was 18 years old. That was not my plan. You know, I didn't plan on seeing 30, and I knew I'd be drunk when it went by. I didn't think I'd even be alive to see it. And so it was not my intention to do this. But the day came when it wasn't my choice anymore. I woke up that morning and I had one thought on my mind, to smoke that one lousy joint. And I had never really liked pot, but it was there. And that's why I did it. It was there. That's why I don't keep that sort of stuff around me, because if it's there, it's likely I'll do it. So it's a way that I protect myself. And so I set about the things I had to do that day, and the minute I lit that match, the conflict was more explosive than it had ever been before. Obviously, one lousy joint is not the highest I've ever been or done anything more to me, but it did exactly what nobody and nothing had ever been able to do before. And I didn't know that when I did smoke that joint before, but I knew it afterwards because, you see, it kicked me off the fence of reservation and indecision I didn't even know I was sitting on. Because, you see, I thought I had surrendered to this way of life. But it was very obvious after this that I had not. I knew that I do not want to keep breathing if this is the way I have to live. Running my own life, going like in the same circle all the time with no direction, no purpose, absolutely useless. I do not want to keep living if this is what it's about. But I knew where to go for the solution. And I was just done. It was no big deal, whammy, or the worst that had ever happened to me. It was just going to be my day. I didn't plan on it that way. And so I went to the old timers of Alcoholics Anonymous and I asked them, what do you do to stay sober? That was the only question because, you see, I didn't have any more smart questions and cute answers and big differences about me why I can't get sober. And, you see, I'm sure a lot of you have the same question asked you. Isn't it hard to be sober so young? I don't know. I don't know if it is. Because, you see, when I was 17, my age and your age was a big deal. It was a big difference. When I was 18 and wanted to be sober, my age and your age was irrelevant. It had no bearing. There was no color. There was no gap. Because when we talk the language of the heart here, there is no separation for me. So. They told me what we tell people still today, 17 years ago. We don't take the first drink or anything that affects us from the neck up. We're regulars in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. We get a sponsor, get a home group. We study our book of Alcoholics Anonymous and take its steps. We get a God of our understanding and try and pass this on to others. Well, I have always not taken that first drink or anything that affects me from the neck up, and I have always gone to meetings. The rest of the stuff has varied. Most of the time has been an active part of my life, but there have been times, too, when I have been lazy and when I have not been of service and when I have gotten very much into self-centeredness. As I said, I was 18 when I got sober, and I'm just about to start living for the first time. And over these past 17 years, I have done all kinds of things, right, wrong, left, right, up, down, legal, illegal, moral, immoral, proper, improper, you know. It doesn't excuse the negative things. However, I do have a way of life that when they get so uncomfortable, I have a way to remedy them and to make them right. Because life is life and it's going to get passed on that, hey, this doesn't work, but I know you're going to have to try it anyway, just to believe me. And so I have my first 4 years of Alcoholics Anonymous, I was very active. I was in a meeting every night. And I went to work in AA function, either a meeting or a service commitment or something. I was very, very involved. I was involved in a couple of bids for Minneapolis St. Paul to get the Icky Paw a few times. And have, you know, been involved with young people's activities as well. And when I was almost 4 years sober, I moved to Atlanta. And I had a sponsor all lined up there. I had a man sponsor there who was and still is 27 years sober, longer than me, and the best example of Alcoholics Anonymous in that area I saw. And I chose to make my home group his home group, the Sky Island group, met twice a week. And what happened, I guess, when I moved down there, I figured I knew something. And I did not utilize the sponsor like I would utilize him later and my sponsor today, but I started making decisions. And one more time, when I start making decisions and don't run them by a sponsor, I start to get in trouble. And so I decided that, I don't really know this area very well, so I think I'll go to like 2 or 3 meetings a week, kind of break myself in here. And let me tell you, that is not the way to do it. If you ever relocate, I hope you'll go to a meeting every night for 90 days. That's the way to do it, not the way that I did it. I decided 2 or 3 meetings. Well, When I give a number, it's usually I go with the lesser number. It becomes two. You know, it never jumps to four. It becomes two. And so over a short period of time, I'm basically doing two meetings a week, and I find I'm 6 years sober, and I'm restless, irritable, and discontent, and I don't know why, and I'm getting a little bored with AA, and God, I've heard that speaker before, and I've heard that guy share, when's he ever going to take his inventory, you know, and you start, you know, judging the people in your home group that at once upon a time were wonderful, you know, and I don't know, you know, I don't like feeling that way about members of my home group. I know they're human, and so am I, but I don't want to start taking their inventory. These are the people that I support and who support me, so I want to keep them in good favor in my own eyes as much as possible. And so, but when I'm restless, irritable, and discontent, I'm going to look at you. And so what happened is I know today why I'm restless, irritable, and discontent, because I looked at my actions. Very simply, it's the actions that make the difference for me. And when I was 4 years sober, and as today also, I arrive at my home group meeting an hour before the meeting starts. And now at 6 years sober, I find I'm arriving about 5 minutes before the meeting, walking in, getting my coffee, and sitting down. As now and 4 years sober, I was one of the last people to leave the meeting, because the fellowship and fun afterwards is a lot of fun too. At 6 years sober, I find I'm leaving right after the Lord's Prayer, sort of like, amen, shake, shake, okay, see y'all next week, bye, and you're looking at taillights. And, you know, and I wonder why I'm feeling restless, irritable, and discontent. I'm treating the Alcoholics Anonymous like it's some art class or something, you know, like, well, got that out of the way. And you see, I cannot afford to take my life, which is Alcoholics Anonymous, so nonchalantly, well, no big deal. I just can't do that. This is my life I'm talking about. And I need to participate in it. And so what happened is, I'm 6 years sober, and about 3 weeks later, I thought I discovered why I was restless, irritable, and discontent, and I met him. And I tell you this year about this year of my sobriety for a number of reasons. Number one, it was the worst year of my sobriety to date. Last year was my second worst year of sobriety. Actually, 92 was more so. And I tell you because I don't ever want to live this way again. And I've also seen so many people go through this, whether it be with men or women or parents or children or their dog or their property or whatever it is. It's called obsession. And I have seen more people drink over obsessions. And it's so dangerous to people like me. It is fatal. It is fatal. And so what happened is I meet this little fella. In my case, it happened to be a couple of fellas. And not at the same time, you know, I mean. And I was busy enough with one. I couldn't handle two. Mentally. So I meet this little fella, and I thought, well, hey, it must be an omen. It's a Friday night. Lots of things happen to me on Fridays. Okay. He's single. That's good news. I mean, you know, it hadn't always mattered, you know. He had a lot of money. That was even better news. And, well, by golly, he's got 13 years of sobriety, but he hadn't been in a meeting in 3 years. But, hey, no problem. I go to meetings. I'll help him. And so I set out to help this little fella, whether he wanted it or not. And he didn't, but I persevered. And I did my best and to be an attraction there. Well, I'll tell you, it began a dance of death for me, and it would be as if the light switch of insanity had been flipped on inside of me. Because what happened in retrospect that I can see is that this little fella, for me, became a focal point in my life, just like alcohol and drugs had been the focal point of my life almost 7 years prior. Everything I did, said, went, everything involved that. And now it was a human being. And My entire life is running around this. He certainly didn't make this invitation to me. I just took this on. And it was during this period of time that I just absolutely took a dive. I was self-will run riot. I thought about all kinds of very destructive, attention-getting things that, of course, we know would not have worked, but I still thought about them. You know, I thought about suicide. Temporary suicide, of course, you know, nothing permanent. He wasn't that wonderful. And I thought about running my car off those bridges and running up against those guardrails and getting drunk at him, that'll do it. And just some very, very, you know, demonic kinds of thinking and thoughts. And the saving grace that I had, I mean, I was willing to sell out and had in almost every area of my life, but I had about a half ounce of sanity left that knew I had to continue to go to meetings no matter what. Because I had been raised in Alcoholics Anonymous with that attitude. You go to meetings no matter what. I don't care if you want to go. It's irrelevant. You go. And I knew that the minute I made my first excuse not to go to the meeting, my second excuse would come twice as easy. And I have seen that happen with people, whether it be with meetings. I've seen it happen with me in other areas. It has never been one on meetings. But I've seen the real big debate on the first decision of what I know is not the right thing to do. Second time I have to make it, there is no debate. And it's so dangerous when we're talking about my sobriety. Or anything that leads up to the fact of my not living this as a way of life, these principles. And so what happened is I always go to meetings, but boy, I certainly was no star member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, they were not saying, and yes, you too at 6 years can look like this, you know? I mean, I was walking in with just a pity pot and an attitude of, do not offer me a solution. I like the problem, you know. Walking in crying, leaving crying. I don't care what you say. Those newcomers are sick. You talk to them. You know, I'm into myself. I don't want to get out, you know. A crazy woman on the inside. I don't know what I looked like on the outside, but I hope it wasn't anything like I looked on the inside. And I just, you know, I just couldn't wait to get out of there to go try and find where he was and all that kind of crap. I mean, it was just a terrible 3 months of insanity. And, you know, God had thrown a lot of roadblocks in front of me, and I just conveniently ignored them or jumped them or went around them. But finally, he threw one in there that I couldn't deny. And after 3 months of this whirlwind romance, of which I was the only one involved, the guy got married to somebody else. But I was a good sport. I let him go. And, you know, and it was sort of like I went around the corner and it, like those little pop-up clown things, you know. There was another little fella, very similar in qualifications. And so we did this dance of death for 3 months, and, well, I watched him walk down the aisle with somebody else as well. And so I kind of gave up on relationships for a while, and it just wasn't working the way I thought it should. And thankfully, you know, I did finally let go. It all came crashing down. I really didn't have a lot of choice. That's usually what happens to me, is that it all came crashing down. And so what happened is that I, at almost 7 years of sobriety, I knew it was like the jig's up. You know, I knew I was done. I thought I'd been done a lot of times, but I knew I was done. And so I knew that the next step that I took, I am at the fork in the road. You either make a new commitment to Alcoholics Anonymous or you drink. There's no more running time. There's no more grace time anymore. The decision is now. And I knew I wanted to be sober a lot more than I wanted to drink. And so I went to my sponsor and we began to take these steps anew. As if I had never taken them before, I took them as thoroughly and completely as I could. I took another inventory. Now, I would like to think that I had taken these steps before, but it was going to do me a lot more good to do them again and not rest on that old stuff. It had to be current and fresh and just right now. I went to a convention a few weeks later, and I heard a couple things that made very good sense to me and applied to me. And Friday night, I heard that people, places, and things don't make me happy. This guy's talking about his drinking years. I'm talking about almost 7 years of sobriety. That's exactly what I'm looking for at. And I altered the words to fit me a little bit more appropriately to be men, money, and mansions don't make me happy, because that's what all these little fellows had to offer, in my opinion. And because, you see, I just kind of looked at it, and I didn't think there was anything wrong with wanting to just simply be humbly mega wealthy. You know, that's what I wanted to do. And then the spiritual nature of our lives will just flow in, because I won't have any worries and problems, and that looked very appealing to me. And but of course, that was going to also get me drunk and probably kill me, because that's not how it works. And Saturday night I heard something that was totally unexpected. I heard that if I have old family business to take care of, I better do it before they die. And I say, gosh, I wish I would have. And there was one amend that I had not made, and that was to my stepmother, because it was the most painful, the most difficult, and I didn't really want to do it. I knew I would do it someday, but there had never been an ounce of sincerity in making it prior to that moment. But when he said that, I knew now was the time. And so when I went through these steps, and it was right around the end of October when I began, and when I got about mid-December, I made amends to my stepmother, and I cleaned up the wreckage of my past. And I got current, really current in my life for the first time, and I've always tried to stay current, and to best of my knowledge, I am today. And so I felt so good, and I lived on that good feeling that I knew in my heart, down to my toes, I had taken these steps. And I'm 8.5 years sober, and now I'm kind of a little lacking in enthusiasm, a little restless, and kind of discontent, and a little bored, and you know, just wondering, why can't it just always stay that way? Why can't I always be enthusiastic? Why can't I always be excited about AA? And I'll tell you, one more time, sitting in my home group meeting, I got the answer. And you see, I will be forever thankful that nobody got up and tripped over me to go get a cup of coffee or go to the bathroom or had to tell me about their hot date that night. Because if, you know, I don't ever want to be the person who causes you to miss whatever it is you're supposed to hear, just because I don't like the speaker, or they're kind of boring to me, or they're reading how it works. And God, I've heard that 75 million times. Maybe the newcomer sitting next to you is hearing it for the first time. Did you ever think about that? And I'm so glad that nobody stumbled and caused me to miss what this man had to say, because, not to make it sound big and wooey and dramatic, but I believe that he saved my life, because I have never forgotten what he said. And that was, he was talking about being restless, irritable, and discontented after a number of years of sobriety, and he said that he realized he was trying to live today on last year's program. And I thought, my God, that is exactly what I have been doing. I've been trying to live on what I did a year and a half ago. That this is the day that I have to participate in life. This is the day that I make my contribution to wherever I go. How can I be of service in wherever it is that I'm going? This is the day I'm in Memphis. Why? Who knows? It doesn't really matter. We don't have to know in advance. We may never know. But I'm here. We booked it, and I'm here. And so these are the things that I had learned, that, you know, there aren't any badges or medals of Alcoholics Anonymous that I can polish up every night and then adorn them on my lapel and say, well, now, this is when I took my inventory, and, oh, yeah, this was that amend, and, you know, there aren't any of those kinds of things in Alcoholics Anonymous. And yet there are. There are badges and medals, and I'll tell you where I found them. I found them in the eyes of the old-timers 17 years ago, and I still find them there today. Because, you see, when I went to them and asked them, what do you do to stay sober, their eyes told me everything. And I do believe the eyes are the window of the soul. You see, these were people who were standing still in their own skin, and I didn't know how you did that. There was a peace inside that I knew was not chemically induced. There was a God about them that they put their trust in, that life is going to be okay no matter what happens to me. And I saw it. They didn't even have to say a word. You know, life goes on. And as a friend of mine in my home group says that, you know, I'm not immune to life's little bullets. Life happens. I've had many more joys than I've had heartaches. I have had so many gifts in sobriety, even out of the sad times. You know, I'm moving along in sobriety and things are going fine, and what do you do when at 16 years of sobriety your life falls apart? It makes an abrupt turn without your permission. I don't know what you do, but I'll tell you what I did. I got even more closer to my sponsor. I got even more involved in Alcoholics Anonymous. I went to even more meetings. Because you see, the thing about life is that I will always know, because of Alcoholics Anonymous, that y'all have gone through things far more difficult, far more challenging, far more painful than I will ever go through. And you've walked through it with dignity and grace. You've shown me how to do that too. I have learned and tried to practice the fact that my home group's unity is more important than my personality problems. I don't want to ever have anybody know in my home group who I like and who I don't like. It's irrelevant. The unity and safety of a safe haven of my home group is more important to me than anything. That newcomer coming in, this is their last hope. Let's not forget what our purpose is there. It's not just to stay around the people we know and the little coffee deals and hubbub and hobnob and all kinds of stuff. Let's not forget what our job is there. And that is my job. It is my job to shake everybody's hand. That is my goal every Monday night. That's my home group meeting night. And we have over 200 people there every Monday night. My job is to shake everybody's hand and try to remember their name. And most of the time that I do that. And so what you have shown me, you've shown me how to live like a lady in Alcoholics Anonymous. You've shown me how to live and walk through things with some dignity and some grace. You've shown me what this way of life feels like and looks like. And for that, I shall be forever grateful. Thank you.